against Columbia College. Mr. Woods.
Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Attorney Freddie Woods, appearing for the appellant, Mr. Michael Flowers. This is an appeal from the district court's grant of motion for to dismiss under 12b-6 for failure to state a claim upon which relief could be granted. This appeal explores whether the plaintiff can state a claim upon which relief can be granted against his direct employer A for the retaliatory actions taken against him for engaging in Title VII activity against his indirect employer B. At the outset, this particular situation should be distinguished from interference or aider and abettor liability, in which employer B is actually not a de facto employer or in fact is a non-employer. That interference liability was specifically rejected in EOC versus Illinois. This case.
Let me ask you, counsel, what may seem a strange question. Suppose this were a workers' compensation case and your client had been hurt on the job. Who would have been the employer for purposes of Illinois law for compensation purposes? Columbia College or the city school system?
I believe that the test that the Industrial Commission would use is similar to that of whether or not he's an independent contractor. The test that they would utilize is one of control. So it would be the same test that this court should apply. You look as to whether or not Columbia would obviously be the direct employer and whether or not the CPS would have engaged in a level of control in which the Industrial Commission would therefore find that as an employer, they would be responsible under the Workers' Compensation Act.
You don't think there's any chance they would say that nobody is responsible, which was the outcome here, roughly?
No, Your Honors. I think that they would look at the level of control and determine whether or not that person or that employer could be defined as an employer under the Act.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This circuit hasn't had occasion to really answer this question. That question has been answered in the Second Circuit in the McMenemy decision. In that case, the Second Circuit has held that in situations where employer A retaliates against the employee for engaging in protected activity under Title VII against employee B, that there could be a basis to state a claim upon which relief can be granted.
How close does the relationship have to be between the two different companies?
Well, basically, the McMenemy court looked at the relationship. They didn't really necessarily state a test, but they basically gave a situation where the relationship is so close that there is an inference that employer A would want to retaliate against employer B, against the employee for engaging in protected activity against employer B. So I guess one would look at the nature of the contractual relationship between employer A and employer B.
In your view, does that matter?
Suppose
Flowers had supported a discrimination claim filed by an employee of NASA, right? And Columbia College says, we just don't like anybody who supports discrimination claims. You're fired.
I think that would
be...
Are
you conceding that there's no protection in that case?
Yes, but that case is distinguished from this case. It was specific...
Why are you conceding that there's no protection in that case?
That would be similar...
That's a puzzle to me.
That would be similar to the Wimmer decision, in which the police officers... in which a claim was brought, and the police officers were basically engaging in activities against non-employees or third parties or the general public. And the court basically said in the Wimmer decision that because there wasn't this close relationship between...
What does any of this have to do with the language of the statute?
Well, the statute says that it looks at a broader application. Any activity or any...
But one, let me put it this way. One would think, reading the statute in a naive way, that if Flowers had supported a discrimination claim filed by a NASA employee and had been fired as a result of that, he would have a claim under Title VII.
Well,
and I'm surprised that you're giving that away.
Well, first, does that assume that he is a de facto employee of NASA?
No, it doesn't have anything to do. There's nothing in the statute about de facto employees, is there? Am I missing something?
Well, I think the de facto question comes up as to whether or not he's an employer. The situation is similar to the Abbott case. In Abbott, you have this situation where there is an employer A and an employer B. And the court really looked at whether or not they're going to find any liability against employer B in that instance, as to whether or not they were a de facto employer. And because they couldn't find that level of control, they said...
I just don't see where in the statute this de facto employer stuff comes from. Is it all just made up?
No. The statute basically says, and it has a broader application, it says that, and if you give me a moment...
Please continue with your argument.
Well, I was, to answer the court's question, it shall be unlawful employment practice for the employer to discriminate against any of his employees because he has made a charge, testified, insisted, mm-hmm. or participate in any manner in an investigation proceeding hearing under this chapter.
Right.
So
that's the source of my question. Why does the charge or proceeding have to be a proceeding involving the employer, right? Flowers is an employee of Columbia College. On this, everybody agrees.
That's correct.
And if Flowers had supported or made a charge concerning NASA, who is not his employer, directly, indirectly, de facto, de jure, anything, why, on a simple, straightforward, empty-headed reading of the statute, is he not protected against retaliation by Columbia College, his actual employer?
Well, actually, I would argue that if the court reads Sibley and Christopher and the other cases, the answer would be yes. Because if you read the statute as it's clearly
that's
written...
That's the right answer, right?
If you read it as it's clearly written...
Then we don't
written,
have to worry about who's closely related to whom and who is de facto employer or anything like that.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that would be really the spirit and the intent of Congress to stamp out discrimination for participation...
I must tell you, I care much less about their spirit and intent than what they actually enacted.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that would be the clear reading and unambiguous reading of the statute itself.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'll actually reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Woods.
Thank you.
Ms. May.
May it please the court. Jane May for Columbia College, Chicago. Michael Flowers did not engage in protected activity when he filed an EEOC charge against the Chicago Public Schools, or CPS, and that is because he did not have a reasonable, good faith belief that he was complaining of conduct that violated Title VII because he had no employment relationship with the Chicago Public Schools. Mr. Flowers is now trying to claim he had a de facto employment relationship if he did not have an actual one. But we don't even need to get to that point because Judge Zagel ruled in Mr. Flowers' original Northern District of Illinois case against the Chicago Public Schools that complaint was frivolous because he had no employment relationship.
What significance does that have? It was a dismissal at the former pauperous stage. And does that have any preclusive effect in later litigation when the plaintiff pays the filing fee?
I believe it does. It was Judge Zagel.
And what do you think about the Supreme Court's decision in Denton against Hernandez, which holds that it has none?
Well, I believe this circuit has held in Okoro that it can have the collateral estoppel effect.
You think we overruled the Supreme Court?
Well, I believe what you can hold is
what,
that...
Let me put it straight in a straightforward way. How do you read the holding of Denton against Hernandez? Would you try to reconcile your position with the holding of Denton?
I believe that in certain circumstances, in a 1915 dismissal, the reason for the dismissal can have preclusive effect in subsequent litigation.
And how is that position consistent with Denton against Hernandez?
I'm sorry,
If you don't know Denton, you should have said that to start with rather than trying to bluff.
I'm sorry. If I can go on, and even beyond the collateral estoppel issue, in the if we look to what is pled in the complaint, if we look to the employment relationship that Mr. Flowers has attempted to assert between himself and the Chicago Public Schools in the amended complaint, he has essentially pled that there was none. He has pled that Columbia was the entity that was primarily responsible for his employment and training when he performed services at Diet. And he has pled that Diet, the Chicago Public Schools, only was feeding information to Columbia about him. That essentially pleads and confirms what Judge Zagel ruled, that there was no employment relationship. And to show in this case that he did engage in protected activity when he filed a claim against Chicago Public Schools, he has to demonstrate that he had some sort of employment relationship with that entity, and he has not done that. In fact, he's pled himself out of court on that issue.
So your answer to Judge Easterbrook's NASA employee is that you could fire that person and not violate Title VII?
Well, it depends. It depends if the NASA complaint that was supported by the employee was a good faith, reasonable Title VII claim. If it was not, then a subsequent retaliation claim cannot be made. And the Seventh Circuit recently, in the Mattson case, held that whether or not the claim is brought under the opposition clause or the participation clause in Title VII's retaliation provision, there still must be a good faith, reasonable basis for one to believe that they are complaining of or opposing some practice that is protected under Title VII. So even in the NASA analysis, if the complaint was outrageous or had no basis in the law, a subsequent retaliation claim could not have been maintained. But beyond the de facto analysis, you then get into the issue of whether or not Columbia can be held liable for allegedly retaliating against the plaintiff for complaining about another entity's conduct. And Mr. Flowers has relied extensively on the McMenemy case. And there, I think there was an unusual overlap or significant relationship between the union and the city who was the defendant.
Yeah, well, look, let me give you another version of the NASA hypothetical.
Sure.
Let's suppose Flowers worked for NASA and was a victim of discrimination and files a charge of discrimination against NASA. Later, he goes to work for Columbia College. Columbia College finds out that he filed a charge against NASA and says, we don't like in our workplace people who have ever made charges of discrimination. You're fired. Does Title VII allow that?
If the original complaint against NASA was one that had a reasonable basis in the law...
I'm assuming it had a reasonable basis.
It could.
What do you mean it could? Columbia College could fire him if the original complaint...
No, I don't mean that.
You want to concede, I trust, that Columbia College could by no means fire him.
I believe that's true. And really, the real issue here is...
So everything has to collapse to the question whether the charge, as originally filed, had some conceivable basis.
Right.
And now let me ask you the question I asked your adversary, which is, if he had been injured on the job, who would have been liable to pay workers' compensation?
I believe it would have been Columbia.
But why? You think that's a straightforward rule?
Well, I'm not that familiar with workers' compensation law, but in the Title VII
arena...
Yeah,
same problem. The thing I'm getting at is that the borrowed servant doctrine can be fairly complex. Knowing who your employer is when you're injured on the job or receive a discrimination injury when you're at somebody else's workplace other than your technical employer can be somewhat complex. Your position seems to be that if you get that question wrong, you forfeited all your rights under the statute. And indeed, your employer can fire you just for getting it wrong.
Well, I don't think the...
If that were carried over to workers' compensation, I expect you would be paying punitive damages for having undermined somebody's rights under the workers' compensation system. But you say that because this is a Title VII claim, the employee can be fired. That seems kind of tough to get to.
In this case, though, I don't think it's such a close call as to who his employer was, and I don't think if you look at the amended complaint that it appears to be such a close call. When he has pled that Columbia was the entity that was actually primarily responsible for his employment and training, and when he's pled that Columbia was controlling the program, the OCAP program in which he was performing services, that demonstrates a concession by Mr. Flowers that Columbia actually was the entity pulling the strings with respect to his employment and not Chicago Public Schools. Chicago Public Schools was simply the environment in which he was performing his services for Columbia. And for the reasons I've stated, namely that he was not the actual nor the de facto employee of Chicago Public Schools, he didn't engage in protected activity, and we would ask that Judge Koukouras' ruling in this case be affirmed.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Ms. May. Anything further, Mr. Woods?
Counsel relies a lot on the underlying decision by Judge Zagel that the underlying complaint was frivolous. In addition, she produced the Mattson pursuant to 28J to support that position. However, a clear reading of Mattson, in that case, it was a sexual harassment case in which an individual accused his employer of sexually harassing him by merely brushing up against him, and the court averred that clearly he would have no good faith reason to believe that he had a Title VII claim. That case is really distinguished from this case because we're talking about a technical deficiency and who is his employer at the time of the filing. Judge Zagel made his determination because under Title VII, one has to designate a Title VII claim against his employer, and that was not done by Mr. Flowers. In my amended complaint, I merely brought, in my pleading, I indicate that the underlying case was dismissed by Judge Zagel because he had filed it against his non-employer. That was an accurate statement of the facts of the case. This is a case that we're looking at this case from the pleading stage, and under the pleading rules of this court, I need only provide notice to the other side. I made in my pleading an indication that Columbia exercised control over Mr. Flowers, therefore meeting my burden to establish that the CPS engaged in control over Mr. Flowers. So the fact that counsel wants to argue that I pled myself out of court is not the case. I merely pled what occurred at before Judge Zagel. I made my pleading by the notice requirements. I made conclusions as to who directed and controlled. I indicate that although Columbia engaged in a reporting factor that CPS controlled.
Thank you very much, Mr. Woods.
Thank you.
Case taken under advisement.